Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome back to the It's Become a Whole Thing podcast. I am your host, Emily Rose, and I'm here with everyone's favorite co-host, Sammy P.
Thank you. Hello.
You're welcome. Hello. Thank you. And yes. Hello. And thank you very
yum,
much.
Yum, yum, yum.
Oh, God. Jumping on the NPC trend like 5 months late. Or maybe it was 3 months. Time is a flat circle.
I would have guessed 8 months.
Maybe. Who's to say? Maybe a cursory Google search, but it's not what we're here for today. We have solved a mystery. There's a, on the recording platform that we're using, there have been mysterious signals popping up in the midst of really tense discussions where a little thumbs up pops up in the middle of the screen. And I realize it's connected to me doing a thumbs up. And then there's some AI program where it then sends in a little emoji thumbs up. But I recorded a whole episode about grief with John, and we were talking with our hands a lot. So we were talking about our dead moms, and there kept being like little thumbs up popping up on the screen. So now we know.
I you say you know. I'm not 100% convinced. I honestly genuinely think it's a ghost doing it. Like, I think it is like a signal from your mom from beyond the realm. And because as much as you're doing it, it is happening and it isn't happening. Like, the thumbs up, it's like we're at like a 50% success rate. So I think it's still a mystery. If anyone knows anything about Zencastr and huge ghostly thumbs up appearing in the screen, let us know.
If anyone knows about either AI programming or dead relatives appearing via recording devices, let us know.
Any mediums out there, please reach out. Like, I have been trying to find a good animal communicator, and
I think
it's
tough. Booked and busy.
I know. They're being gatekept too. Like, on TikTok, when people make those like amazing slideshows of like everything my animal communicator told me that my horse was thinking, and it's like so detailed, and I'm like 100% believing, and everyone in the comments is like, who is it? Nothing. No response. They are gate fucking keeping.
Yeah, they all have these web 2.0 websites. They all, it's like a PDF for a website. You know, they're not, animal communicators are not the most tech savvy people, and
every paragraph is in different fonts, different colors.
Yes.
It's like a purple background, pink font, like, they're which really is amazing.
They're the opposite of coaching girlies who are everywhere where no one's asking for them. Everyone's yeah, a coach exactly. to be a coach, to be a social media coach. And that is a real, that's a new plague upon our society that's popped up in recent years. Animal communicators are nowhere to be found. I think you just need to go to a zoo and just walk around and just feel it out.
Yeah, I hope that me saying this into the universe calls one into my life, because I really need to know what my poodle is thinking ASAP.
I need to know too. And when I think about getting one for myself, I think about how you once said that I don't think Sid is thinking very much. And that's disrespectful, but perhaps true, because I'll just say he's emotionally intelligent.
I think he has a peaceful inner monologue. I don't think it's anything like negative. Like,
it's not peaceful. It's not peaceful. People are like, is he a rescue? I'm like, well, I got him from a farm when he was 2 months old. But if you're asking about his neurotic behavior, that is just me. Just for me.
Oh, right. He has his little problem. How's he doing with that, by the way?
Yeah. He's like, oh, my owner is anxious and unsettled. Let's find the source of danger. And it's any dog bigger than me. And I will destroy it. Yeah. So that's fun. That's really fun.
So he hasn't chilled out on that?
No.
Okay.
No. No, he has not.
Oh, dang it. Sid, I was hoping in his old age he would, like, stop being such a killer.
He's, for the record, he's not killed. He's not killed nor maimed, but no, he acts like a drunk bro who's like, I could fight, but he never really goes for it, but he makes a big scene.
Yeah, he's not biting to kill, but he does attack a little bit. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry you're dealing with that. I'm sorry for Sid. And that's something an animal communicator could help with. You tell him to stop.
I mean, yeah, maybe.
Well, saw what happened with that jaguar.
Right. If anyone wants to know more, you can listen to our animal communicator episode where we really went in, we really believed. And if that's not your cup of tea, well, we're here for all kinds of different coverage of all sorts of different topics.
Hard-hitting news. I was hoping since that episode I could, like, will myself into becoming one. And I've been just believing and hoping and praying every day. And unfortunately, I cannot hear the thoughts of animals. And I tell them and I tell them and I tell them things, and they are not hearing me.
I mean, I spent my whole childhood trying to Matilda my way into doing things, and it didn't work. So I have learned that it doesn't matter how much willpower there is behind it, you can't blow a candle with your mind.
God. Well, maybe some people can, but we can't, I guess.
Your psychic moments come in spurts randomly every couple of years.
Well, I would say I do. I'm like a precog or whatever.
What is that? Is this psychic talk? Are you actually a psychic?
No, that's a Minority Report word. I don't know what is it? It's like you're like clairvoyant or something. I do think I have a sense about the future. I dream about the future all the time and things come to pass. But I don't want that. I want to move things with my mind, and I want to talk to animals, and I want to fly. So
is that so much to ask, ladies?
So much to ask. Come on now. Did you ever watch Secret World of Alex Mack? Speaking of what we're about to get into. Okay. I feel like we're the only two people on earth who watched that show, because I've brought that up so many times over the years and I've been met with only blank stares. I'm like, hello, Larissa Olenek. No, Larissa is the girl from it. She was in 10 Things I Hate About You. She's like the prissy sister.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But what's her name? Alicia Cuthbert. She was a spunky teen on lots of shows that we would have watched.
The Secret World of Alex Mack, where she disintegrates into a little puddle and can slither around into things.
Yeah, and she can control electricity and like a whole bunch of stuff.
If anyone watched those shows as a child and then didn't spend hours trying to become
with all your might, like straining until your face was red, like just trying so damn hard.
God, I was a fucked up little child. I know. I tried so hard that I resorted to threats, actually. I remember this with my stuffed animals. I was like, you will be animated and talk, or I'm going to throw you off the balcony. And I, at one point, I brought out all my other stuffed animals and I threw my favorite one off the balcony. And I was like, I want this to be a message to all of you that no one's special here. This one's my favorite and I will sacrifice it. And I'll sacrifice all of you if one of you doesn't start fucking talking to me right now.
Love that. That is Scorpio behavior.
That's only child Scorpio behavior left to my own devices.
You guys think I won't fucking kill my favorite child to get what I need?
I will tear you each apart piece by piece until one of you speaks up. All right? Capiche?
Oh, God.
Yeah, that is Scorpio behavior. Yeah, a child's mind is a beautiful thing. That is not a segue into today's
horrific terrible
episode.
Segue, but it is a segue because we're talking about children's TV and the wonders that can come from children's TV in the lives of the children watching them, mm-hmm. and how great and affirming it can be. But
yeah, well, before we dive into that, I'll just give a little lay of the land here. So this episode is going to come out, and then I've got a bonus episode coming out on Wednesday, which is with John Joseph. We recorded almost 2-hour episode on grief. We got listener questions about grief and death and had an epic conversation about it. And then there's Patreon every Wednesday. And then next week, we'll be taking a break from the podcast. We'll still be putting out Patreons. And yeah, I think last week we put out about 3 hours of content on Patreon for Hot Topics, VPR recaps. We recapped the Valley. So patreon.com/ it's become a whole thing. Anyhow, so that's going to be the next week or two. Okay, let's get into today's episode. So you saw from the title that it's about Quiet on Set. I'm going to just put a big blanket content warning. This is going to be a very challenging topic throughout. Very, very dark. Watching it felt a bit like when we watched Finding Neverland.
I thought about that a lot.
Mm-hmm. When I'm saying that, I just mean personally, we've had some requests over the years to cover it on the podcast, but we watched it years before the podcast was ever a thing, and I actually can't rewatch it. It was very traumatic, but I think important to see.
Yeah, it's a one-time watcher for sure. It's hard, but considering the impact that Michael Jackson has on pop culture, I do think everyone should watch it who is in any way interested in him or his music or pop culture or in general, and mm-hmm. how these things work behind the scenes. There's a lot of overlap between that and this. There's a lot of overlap between this and Corey Feldman's documentary that he put out a few years back, which I watched in preparation for this episode too, because I was like, didn't he name Brian Peck in that? I just kind of thought I remembered that. And he does, along with many other behind the scenes people, as well as Charlie Sheen, which I didn't know about or I didn't think was really picked up by the media. But there was extremely serious allegations against Charlie Sheen by Corey Haim in that movie. And I just, I want to shout out like the bravery involved with everyone who comes forward, everyone who makes movies like this. Corey Feldman had several attempts on his life made after he put out his movie. Cars were trying to hit him. He was getting death threats. His family was getting death threats. And the movie was, he said, stolen. Like, there was hackers interfering with it the first screening. Then it never got picked up. Like, you can be really, like, silenced when you try to speak out and bring justice to these things. So it's pretty scary.
Yeah, when there's so much money involved and so much power, truth can be really stranger than fiction. And I also want to shout out, in the wake of Quiet on Set coming out, a lot of people are hounding former Nickelodeon stars who haven't spoken out and are saying, like, your silence speaks volumes. And no one is required to speak about their own abuse, especially what they experienced as a child. Mm-hmm. They don't owe you that. And it's completely understandable to any normal, rational person why someone would not want their name to forever be associated with whatever went on with them. So,
yeah, I feel like any compassionate person should be able to understand why you wouldn't want to speak publicly. And however, on the other hand, I do understand feeling some disappointment or betrayal if you are one of the people who is speaking out. If other people don't, you feel like maybe not backed up, but they're not really the ones saying it. However, I do think the big stars who didn't speak up kind of put themselves at a bit of a disadvantage in this because they played a lot of really humiliating clips of them over and over again, and we didn't get their side of the story. So we're almost left to imagine kind of like the worst things, or I don't know. It's just, certain people I can understand, like Amanda Bynes, is not well enough to speak about this, to be involved in this in any way. And I'm really sorry for her and everything she's gone through. Ariana Grande, I can imagine she's having a really unpleasant week, you know, like 2 weeks, whatever, since this started airing, because they dug up some really, really fucked up stuff that she was involved in.
Let's get into it, and we'll talk more about Ariana Grande throughout. So first off, the documentary is in 4 episodes. We'll cover all 4 in this one. It starts off, we're in the 90s, and they set the stage with there being basically not a lot of options to watch. There was either Nickelodeon or Disney in the States, and Dan Schneider was the person manning the helm of Nickelodeon. He is the face of evil. To me, this documentary is overdue, but maybe society wasn't ready for it before. But they address the stars and describe how they've gone in many different directions. So you have people like Amanda Bynes who've struggled very publicly. You have stars like Jeanette McCurdy who've spoken out directly against Nickelodeon and against Dan Schneider. And a lot of this started to come to a head in 2017 when the internet started circulating old clips from Nickelodeon that were very suggestive, and people started to revisit a lot of the shows they loved as kids and realizing how many inappropriate things are contained within them, how much feet content, clips of Ariana Grande squeezing water out of a potato, just barrage of suggestive imagery. And they got away with this because Nickelodeon was always the fun, quirky, really out of the box, very irreverent, always pushing the limits, but in a way that was really celebrated. But they were pushing the boundaries. So sliming people was a huge part of Nickelodeon and Kids' Choice Awards and everything. That was not anything that we looked at suspiciously at the time, but in light of everything else that's come out, it's unsettling.
Well, the sliming, like the dumping like of a huge bucket of green slime on people as a prank, I don't think is sexually suggestive, but I feel like the slime splat being like their logo and the whole slime association opened the door for, like, we see endless like montages of like cum shot jokes. In this movie, that's clearly a fetish of Dan Schneider's. We see a lot of young girls getting slime across their face and the camera zooming in and you know, very much like sick porn imagery. There was a lot of things that they slid under the door there.
And this was all the brainchild of Dan Schneider. He had started off, he had worked a bit on some popular shows in the 80s and 90s. In 1994, the head of Nickelodeon asked him to write the pilot for this new show that they wanted to put out. And it was positioned as the kind of like the SNL for kids of all that. And he took it. And that's where he planted the seeds of power that he would later hold within Nickelodeon. All that was really progressive. There was no sketch comedy show for kids that had ever been mainstream, but we already hear right away from some of the actors at the time who talked about how often they had to wear leotards, like for superhero costumes, and that already was uncomfortable for them. But we see that some of the leotards that they had to wear, it looked like they were wearing a dick. And
yeah, they had like kind of humiliating costumes that they would put them in sometimes, and the kids felt really clearly that they were never safe to speak out because there was a culture of don't bitch, like shut the fuck up, anyone who is ever going to be annoying or like a killjoy is gonna be fired immediately.
Yeah, and anyone who adheres too strongly to child labor laws, everything was a blurred line.
Nobody was respecting the child labor laws. They were filming like 20-hour days and they were exhausted and they weren't being looked after. The teachers weren't being serious. The set minders were, well, half of the time they were pedophiles themselves and the other half of the time they were not around. So very dangerous set.
And we hear from a lot of parents in this documentary with different levels of protectiveness over their child and different levels of involvement in their children's lives. But even the ones who are extremely involved and extremely protective, we see how much they get pushed out. Either their kid gets fired from the show, they get punished, they get vague threats. You know, do you want your kid to be still living their dream?
Oh, yeah.
Let's keep filming then.
Yeah, that the boy Brian who shares his story, he really like had me crying because it was so insidious what they did to him, both the like racist things that they involved him in skits, but when he described
and that's like, Brian Hearn, just to distinguish, because we're gonna hear from another Brian who has a very different role at Nickelodeon. Right.
When he described like his mom being the only one to ever try to protect her kid verbally to the like higher ups, and how like every time he could tell he was being punished, being pushed out, until one day they were brought together into the office and they were like, you're fired, you won't be asked back, by their agent told them. And then he said from that moment on, like, I hated my mom because I knew that she cost me that opportunity. And he was just a child, and he's having to cope with these adult feelings of rejection, firing, retribution, parental alienation, like, and all she was trying to do was protect him, and she did, but at the cost of his career.
Yeah. And it's the type of thing that becomes so clear as you get older, the ways that parents are being protective, and it's just perceived as annoying and overbearing. And
they were all about driving the wedge.
Yeah, driving the wedge. And referring back to Finding Neverland, a lot of the kids that are the victims in that story, they're really the ones who are the most vulnerable. So with parents who are basically like hands off, kind of that stereotypical stage parent who will just do anything for their kid to have fame, and they'll leave their kids alone with anyone if there's a chance for stardom, and a lot of them come from really poor backgrounds. And there is a little bit of that hinted at in this documentary with some of the parents, particularly Amanda Bynes, that we'll get into, but you see more normalcy within this. You hear from a lot of parents who do seem like they were just trying to support their kids' dreams, and then it spiraled.
Well, any of the parents who ever got the intuitive hit that something was creepy or sexual or over the line, and that spoke out about that, rightly so, was dealt with so severely. I was quite shocked at how calculated it seemed.
It was such a profound culture of gaslighting, where if you bring something forth, like the phallic superhero costume that Brian had to wear, and then a lot of the other things that he had to do later on, but it was also part of this culture was anyone who brought this forth, even reporters, anyone who raised an eyebrow at this type of imagery, it would be immediately push back in their face, like, these are kids, why are you seeing something suggestive? What's wrong with you that you would view this as anything other than innocent?
Right. Yeah. And they thought they were so fucking smart too, but they, like, these writers and like Dan, but they had two female writers that spoke out about the atmosphere in the writer's room, how misogynistic, sexist, disgusting, degrading it was. He would make them act out being sodomized while delivering a pitch. He would make them rub his shoulders all the time. He would make them split a salary, which eventually led to this gender discrimination lawsuit, which they won, but again, at the cost of their careers. Both of them never worked in the industry again.
And that's why they say that no matter whether you win or lose in a lawsuit, you lose, because unless you're already incredibly rich and powerful, you could cost yourself your career or all the legal fees that went into it, or just the time, the years off your life of stress of going up against this huge organization.
And being seen as a troublemaker and a little bitch forever in the industry, like being blacklisted, mm-hmm. because people are like, oh, well, we don't want to get sued. Like, oh, you're such a killjoy, you'll just sue again. Like, you know, people still see these kind of lawsuits as like a money grab all the time and like in bad mm-hmm. faith, basically. But
yeah. And we hear from one of the stars, Katrina Johnson, who was a bit of a rising star at the time, but then she was very closely mentored by Dan, then hit puberty, gained weight, and was ordered to lose weight, but couldn't because, like her mom said, or like she said, she was already dancing 5 hours a day. Like, there's no more weight that can be lost. That's just what she looks like. And she was replaced very quickly by the up-and-coming Amanda Bynes at 10 years old.
Yeah, it's so sad because the scars of rejection that these kids get at this young age just never heal. Like, it really forms part of their identity. And I guess that's why there's no kid SNL, because kids are not mature enough to handle the brutality of, like, hired, fired, you're hot today, you're gone tomorrow. Like, they metabolize that. It just kills them. And she was like, you can tell it still has rattled these people to the core. They're still actively in therapy over this. She's like, first Dan told me that they were going to do the Katrina Johnson show, and then a year later I'm fired and seeing a 10-year-old starring in the Amanda Bynes show, you know, that was supposed to be my concept. And like, it's just like, yeah. Imagine carrying something from when you were 10 like that, like, or whatever she was, 14.
And it's like, it's Beyonce's, part of Beyonce's origin story that she was 7 or 8 and on this show auditioning to win, and she lost, and it was
Star Search,
and she was devastated, but then came back even stronger and, you know, became
Jessica
Beyonce.
Simpson too, when she was cut from the Mickey Mouse Club. Like, that took up a lot of chapters in the book. Like, it's just, it's truly traumatizing.
Mm-hmm. And then, yes, there's only so many Beyoncés and Jessica Simpsons in the world, and the rest of them are faded off into obscurity. But we also get the perspective from a lot of them that it was likely a gift in disguise, because while they faced that challenge of rejection, they were also protected from all the predators that worked at Nickelodeon, they later found out. And so, mm-hmm. unfortunately, Amanda Bynes is one of the saddest stories to come out of this whole saga, and how rare it was to have a female comedian be so prominent at the time, so young, and bring this talent forth that no one connected to either her sexuality or her innocence. She was just really a trailblazer.
She was undeniably hilarious and brilliant comedian as a freaking 10-year-old girl. Like, you just don't see kids being that funny and that smart. It's almost like bizarre to see. Like, she's like a prodigy. Like, when you see her up there just killing the mic, killing the audience. It's like, what is going on?
I know. They talk about discovering her. They show a clip of her doing stand-up at 10, and she really is a comedy prodigy.
She's at the club. She's at, like, the Comedy Cellar doing a stand-up routine at age 10.
Working
the
stage.
She's so funny. Yeah. She's truly, like, a shining superstar. Like, and that's what they said. Like, they said as soon as Dan got his eyes on her, he was like, okay, this is the next big thing. Like, it's giving, like, Scooter Braun seeing Justin Bieber on YouTube and being like, oh, okay, this is an undeniable future star, and I'm gonna get my claws into this person.
And like with Justin Bieber, she had parents who were ready to feed her to the wolves. And they don't talk too much about it, but you can read between the lines that Dan immediately picked up on her, scooped her up, and worked very, very closely with her parents, with her dad on set. He worked very closely with Amanda, very closely with Amanda's parents. Her dad was controlling and always there, but in the pocket with Dan Schneider. And she soon got her own show, The Amanda Show, which was huge for the network at the time. And again, this was really ahead of its time. We'd only seen child actors when they were being funny, that they were either super childish and innocent or hypersexualized at too young of an age, and she was neither. She was just funny.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Schneider he keeps on pushing the envelope. So with the costumes, with the characters, one such example is this character he came up with called Penelope Taint. They mentioned how they brought it up. The network executives brought it up and was like, Taint? Like, is this what we think it is? And he's like, no, it's Taint. Like someone's tainted. You know, it's of course not. Why would you, what's wrong with you that you would even think that? He was very clear with his favorites. Very, very clear with his favorites. And one of them was Amanda. And he would keep them very close, both in every sense of the word. So would work very closely, mentor them, and then also was very physically inappropriate. So along with the fact that staff said that there was essentially almost always someone massaging him, almost always some female staffer giving him a shoulder rub, which he would essentially demand. And at the same time, he was very physically inappropriate with Amanda, always close, rubbing her shoulders. They had a sketch that they did together, sitting in a hot tub, just the two of them.
And the whole sketch, like, all the dialogue in the sketch was like, this is Dan, our producer, so he wrote this sketch. And he's like, that's right, I write whatever I want. And, like, it's just like he liked to draw attention to the fact that he could do whatever he wanted to these kids via the writing. And there was another part where they showed an interview of him, like, on a red carpet. And he's like, oh, I love it when the kids get sassy to me because they know I can write anything to the script, and like, I will torture them, I will like put them into a pit of snakes, like they have no idea like what I can do to them. And like, he was a real sicko. And the stuff about the fear factor, I was another moment when I was crying, because I was like, how can you get off like torturing, literally torturing children and like watching them cry. It was called like On Air Dares. And he had them, like, he had Brian, like, covered in peanut butter and being licked by dogs. And he had them, like, eating scorpions and, like, in a pool of, like, snakes or worms. And it was really, it was scary.
It was ominous, terrifying. I mean, very similar to how terrifying Fear Factor was, but.
But with 10-year-olds.
Why was that necessary for kids?
And they made it so extreme. It could have been anything. If you want to do the sketch On Air Dares and you want to pick someone and then make them do something, it could be silly. It could be gross, sure. But like, these were things that really scared and upset the kids and humiliated them. And I just think it takes a certain type of like sexually like perverted person to like be into that.
Of course. And we don't have any record of him actually putting his hands on a child in an illegal way.
They drop that in the very like last minute of the whole series, as they're like, there has been no proof of Dan having an inappropriate physical relationship, like sexual relationship with any of the kids. But I just think we haven't heard about it yet. Like,
yeah, and we might never. We might.
Maybe. There have been rumors, horrible, horrible rumors that he impregnated Jamie Lynn Spears at 16, that he impregnated Amanda Bynes at 13. And yeah, there's no way to know if that's true or just a horrible rumor. But
sometimes it's the worst case scenario, like all the abuse that Aaron Carter suffered. And then he passed away and we're never going to really hear him tell his story. We can only infer what happened to him.
And like we haven't scratched the surface of this yet, but like the whole Drake Bell reveal, they kind of skate over this, but basically he became a predator himself. Like sometimes the victims do go on to do more harm.
So I have a lot of thoughts on that, and I thought that there were some strengths to this documentary but some real weaknesses, and one of the weaknesses was the way that they treated Drake Bell in the context of this. I'm gonna pin in that, like, so I have a lot to say about Drake Bell, but before that we hear about them building up to the height of Nickelodeon, because it's not at the height yet, it's starting to gain prominence. We start to hear from the first real inappropriate occurrences happening. We hear from one of the moms of a child, Brandy, a child actor who was on the Amanda Show. Her daughter is in close contact with one of the production assistants, Jason Handy, and
this little girl, Brandy, we saw her court statements, didn't get to hear from her directly, but they basically ended up saying that this guy Jason Handy, his friendship with her got so close that one day when he was over playing video games, he, you know, grabbed her and started kissing her and stuff, and this was like all in his diary or something. And it's like, why is a 28-year-old man playing video games with a fucking 8-year-old girl alone in a room as a friend? Like, how can a parent be so negligent?
I know. And it's hard because it's like, I'm glad that they're brave enough to tell these stories, but I'm also just so angry at the parents for not protecting their kids. But obviously they've more than paid for it with then what happened. So that's transpiring, a completely inappropriate relationship with Jason and his victim. The mom was aware of this, of essentially him sending porn of himself to her. The mom didn't call the police.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Amanda Bynes continues to be this rising star, but she turns 16. She's becoming a teenager, and Dan wants to ride the coattails of her fame all the way into adulthood. This is his plan. So he creates a show for her on the CW network called What I Like About You. but he was used to being the head honcho. He was used to being the guy in charge who could do anything he wanted, rule tyrannically over the employees. And the CW network didn't like that. And he was pushed out of the writer's room. Eventually, he still was on set as the producer. She was slipping away from him. And then her issue started. So she ran away from home. The police get called. Dan is involved somehow. And he is now encouraging her. This is when she's still 16. Encouraging her to get emancipated. And this is part of a long history of child stars getting emancipated, essentially so that they can work as adults. There's a lot of child labor laws of how long they can work and who controls their money, which is their parents. And once they're emancipated, their manager can control their money. The staff can decide how long they work. But luckily, her attempt to get emancipated fails because the court flags how involved Dan is in this emancipation process. So
what's really sad is that she had good reason to get emancipated from her parents because they ended up stealing all her money and abusing her financially in all these different ways. But imagine this life where you literally have nothing but villains all around you and you have nobody to trust and you're so twisted and gaslit in your mind that you think the worst man on earth is like someone you can trust as like a father figure. It's heartbreaking.
And I should add, of course, that many kids also get emancipated and child stars get emancipated for very valid reasons to get away from their abusive parents. So that's another reason. But then, yeah, with Amanda, it's sad because it's like,
but she had no one.
Out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah, exactly. Like every child, every teen should be able to live with someone they trust who can help them before they're ready to make adult decisions with their money and just safeguard their money for them and till they're a certain age or whatever. But nobody was in her corner like that.
No one. And Dan failed to really break into adult TV and failed to guide Amanda into this new phase of her life. And she was facing her own personal problems, which
that one show didn't work out, but I watched it and it was good. It was funny.
I just mean his involvement. He was not as involved as he wanted. He wanted to be all hands on deck, producing, writing, there for every second, but he was ousted from that. So he went back to Nickelodeon, and it's very harrowing to see this turn of events because Nickelodeon welcomes him back in and there was so much else that went on outside of just Dan, but it is really hard to think of what could have been if he had just fully left Nickelodeon at that point. Mm-hmm. But he goes back to Nickelodeon, keeps pushing the limits, but then we get the first official arrest, the first of three known pedophiles working on the set at the time. So Jason Handy, the production assistant, gets arrested. And his job was to escort kids around the set without their parents. The child labor laws were that the parents always had to be within view of the children, but he was there for the in-between. Awful. What they found at his house was so evil, hard to even imagine. He had tokens of his victims in Ziploc bags
with their names on it, like a serial killer. With their names on it. He had like kids' underwear, their hair, like it was. And not to what he was like, I think what originally he was arrested for was the child pornography on his computer that he was involved in, and that's how they caught him. And then they found like this psycho shit at his house, and he had journals like basically confessing in detail to all the crimes and saying that he was going to get worse and that he was like going to inevitably R-word a kid. And it's like, thank God they found him, but it was too late, of course. But like, yeah, it was just very, very scary, like serial killer shit in there.
Yeah, very, very much. And Jason gets arrested. Then 4 months later, another crew member gets arrested, Brian Peck, who's a dialogue coach. And Brian Peck was both a dialogue coach, but he was also involved in the skits. And it seems like he came up with these concepts. And one of them was Pickle Boy. And Pickle Boy would show up randomly all the time with pickles and make people eat them. And it was suggestive.
They showed the like glory hole skit with Ray Romano where he slides him a pickle through the hole and then Ray eats it. I'm like, damn, they had Ray Romano up in this bitch doing this stuff.
I know. I know. The stars they had on these shows.
Michelle Obama.
I know. There's a photo of Dan Schneider cozying up to Michelle Obama. And it looks like he's sniffing her hair. I'm like, how did this?
I'm sure he did.
How did this happen? And one of the protagonists in the documentary is Giovanni Samuels, who was an actor on the show. And she has this notebook. It was kind of like a yearbook she made of her time at Nickelodeon. And it's like, she has Ryan Peck signing it. It's like, love Pickle Boy. And then next to it, it's like her cozying up to Dan Schneider. And it's just like, it becomes this like evidence. It's not actual evidence in any court case, but it's like, it's just her and a bunch of predatory men. But it's like with that highlighter marker, you know, yearbook, making like a fun yearbook.
Oh, the pictures are so hard to see. The pictures of him like cheek to cheek cuddling these little girls, all these guys, like the way they hug and kiss the kids, and like you can just see that like the kids are like, this is normal, this is Uncle so and so, he loves his hugs. And it's,
yeah,
oh, it's just grooming central over there.
Yeah. And so and meanwhile, this is before Brian's arrest. This is just what was transpiring leading up to it. He was having these kids over to his house all the time for barbecues and parties, and he had the parents were there, so it was all fine, right? And he is bringing these kids to these rooms he has where he's showing them photos.
He has like his house is kind of like Neverland Ranch. He yes. has like a Planet of the Apes themed room and these different like part, you know, tiki themed rooms. It's like kind of like a kid's paradise. But then he has one very disturbing artifact that, what's that boy with the glasses name? He was giving me a lot of great, great interviews. I forget, but he's the one who tells this story about the.
See that he's a pen pal with serial killer. Wait, John Wayne Gacy.
Hey, don't jump the gun here. Oh. First, he says, what a strange picture of a clown you have there in your house. It really sticks out. Like, and he was like, oh, this is one of my treasured pieces. Let me just take off the wall, flip it around, and show you what it has on the back. And it says, like, to my dear good friend Brian Peck, love you so much. Here's a self-portrait of me. Love, John Wayne Gacy. This guy is a prison pen pal and art collector of a man who killed dozens of young boys and buried them in his crawl space, John Wayne Gacy. Now, when we hear the term red flag, I feel like that has lost some meaning over the years. But the fact, and then this kid, so sorry, I forget his name. He's like, okay, that's fucking weird. So he's like, I gathered everyone in the party and made them come out and look and made him present again what he said. So every single adult in that room saw that. Heard that he had been exchanging dozens of letters with John Wayne Gacy over the years and that he was close with him, and still let their kids go to this guy's house. I would snatch my child up so fast and get in a car and speed away and never turn around again if I had been in that situation, I swear to God.
I know. And just someone who doesn't have kids having all these parties where they invite kids over is already a fucking red flag.
And all of these guys pretty much look like, if you had to draw from memory, a scary pedophile. Like, it's not like they're doing a great job fucking hiding. Like, some pedophiles have a wife and kids and they have a whole facade. But none of these creeps did. They were just so obvious and scary all the time. And nobody cared.
No, single men with a utopia of fun trinkets and games filling their house.
And always feeling up little boys and stuff, and little girls in the case of the other guy. Like, all their hands all over their shoulders and stuff. Just crazy.
I know. I'm like, what? I look at with suspicion at parents who say, well, I was just, you know, this was my kid's biggest dream and biggest passion, so I just was bringing them to auditions. But it's like, kids say a lot of things, you know. Kids also say they want to be like a veterinarian. Are you bringing them to veterinary clinic? Like, are you bringing them until 11 mm-hmm. at night to yeah. pursue their passion every day after school?
Right.
A lot of the parents that we hear from who do seem protective. At the same time, I'm like, well, you were indulging your kid by going full tilt with this. There's something in it for the parents too. If they tell you they want to be an actor and you're bringing them every day after school auditioning until 11 o'clock or midnight, that's not just you wanting to promote their passion.
That's a good call, because even the ones who seemed sincere that they didn't want their kid to get molested, they were still out there pounding the pavement and the kids were still paying the mortgage.
Something's in it for them. And so it's not that any of those parents wanted anything bad to happen to their kid, but there was enough there that they might have looked past some of the very clear red flags that were there. So,
yeah, I mean, the only dad who really clocked it that we heard from, he was saying, we're leading into the Drake Bell stuff now, but he was like, when he was Drake Bell's dad, and he's like, when Drake decided that I was interfering with his career by complaining so much and he said he wanted to move in with his mom, I told his mom the most important thing: do not ever let him be alone with Brian Peck. And she failed completely and let him sleep over there constantly. And I wonder what kind of parent could ignore that kind of warning, like, that had already been flagged like that, named and flagged. And then I think, well, why was he even, you know, like, the dad's like, well, I can tell that guy's a pedophile, and as soon as he gets a chance, he's going to molest my kid, so don't let them be alone together. It's like, fucking call the police. Like, you know, like, yeah. Get the kid off the show. Like, protect him.
Yeah, as a parent, if your child is potentially in danger, like, you have to explore every possible avenue and fall on the sword if you have to, and even have them hate you or whatever to protect them. But that wasn't happening. So that is where we meet Drake Bell and his dad. We zoom forward to August 2003. Investigators gathered all the kids, all the actors, in a room. So it's the investigators and Dan. They ask all the parents to leave, and all the lawyers are there. All the Nickelodeon lawyers are there.
Yeah, lawyers, Dan Schneider.
Yeah.
And I think that might be it. Maybe one other guy.
They have the lawyer tell the kids about Brian, about what is revealed about Brian, that he has been charged for pedophilia, and asks if anyone has anything to say. And there's the longest, most awkward pause, because they then mention that he was booked for victimizing a child who was on set for inappropriate relations with a child. They don't go into detail and they don't say what kid. So everyone's looking around wondering who it was. And this was sealed. This information was sealed and this person was kept anonymous until this documentary, and we find out that it is Drake Bell.
Yeah. Yeah. It did seem like this was a secret that was kept very close, even though Drake Bell appeared in open court and testified. And like, it's interesting that people kept this secret so respectfully over the years, even though there was people that knew, Dan Schneider knew. Drake Bell says Dan Schneider was like his only like hero at this time, like basically like the only one who was supportive and just said like, whatever you need, and like, it's not your fault and stuff like that. And so kind of an interesting twist there. Right. So let's get into it, I guess.
Yeah. So Drake talks about how he's never told his story before, until today. So we hear from his dad, you know, we hear about the start of his acting career and how he was brought to prominence with the Drake and Josh shows, a hit. It became one of the biggest hit shows of the network. But Drake describes the parties that Brian would have at his house for the kids and for the parents. And Drake's dad, again, you know, he said, describes Brian hanging out, being way too touchy-feely. And then when his dad brought these concerns to Nickelodeon, they would say, Brian is gay, so maybe you're homophobic.
Yeah, they were like, you're just imagining the worst about like a gay man. He was like, damn, maybe I am. And they had this guy thinking he was wrong. He backed off for a bit because of that. And this guy, Brian, was a very insidious worker. He got in there. He worked his way in, started inviting Drake to hosted his 15th birthday party at his house. Oh, come to Disneyland with me. And just kind of made himself like his friend, even though he's an adult, somehow they find a way to make that feel normal for people.
Well, they're also meanwhile convincing Drake that Brian is convincing Drake that his dad is a bad guy who's trying to be overly involved and steal his money. And it's the perfect alibi. It's the perfect cover for it, because the more the dad is getting fired up and concerned, it's classic grooming. It's setting the stage for what you know is going to happen, which is backlash from the dad, and saying, look, any person like this who's trying to control you, clearly he's trying to steal from you. You need to push him away, which is what happened. And Brian, in fact, helped Drake to hire an attorney to, quote, review his finances. And then his dad gets a call saying Drake doesn't want him as his manager anymore. And the dad is tearing up. He had to agree with it.
He was like, whatever my son wants is fine. That hurts my feelings. The mom became the new manager at the time.
And we don't hear from the mom.
We don't hear from the mom. She comes off looking fucking terribly, in my opinion. But yeah, so that's when he says to the mom, please, please listen to me. The one condition, please do not let him be alone with Brian Peck. But nobody heeds that. And Brian starts being the one to drive him to every single audition, which sometimes go late at night. And then he'd be like, oh, just come back to my place. Like, I don't want to drive you all the way back to Orange County. I'm in LA. Let's just sleep at my place. And yeah, the Disneyland trips, all this stuff. And then one day, you know, Drake's lying in bed and wakes up to him sexually assaulting him while he was asleep. And yeah. I think a lot of us can relate to that feeling of like, oh, you've got me in a position where, what am I really going to do? I can't call my mom and have her drive an hour to come get me. What's going to happen to me in the meantime? Run out to the street and what? Run away? Like, I have my kid. I don't have like a car. I don't have a way to like get out of here.
It's the early 2000s. He doesn't have a cell phone. Doesn't have.
Yeah. An Uber like account. That. He's just like in this guy's scary house and it just wants to like get through to the morning and try to get home and try to like figure this out. But it's just the beginning of a horrific long time of this getting worse and worse.
Yeah. And Drake talks about things escalating and says, you know, as far as details of what happened, he said, imagine the worst possible thing that someone could do to a child. And that's anything that you're imagining is what happened.
We see the legal allegations. That's the only like way this is like conveyed to the audience, is they like put up the lawsuit or the charges or whatever on screen. And it's like unspeakable. I completely understand why he can't even like, after all these years, get there.
Yeah. And all of this got uncovered because Drake Bell suddenly gets a girlfriend and is distancing himself from Brian. And
from his own parents, and spending all his time with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mom, because they're actually seemingly nice and supportive to him. And he like describes this one time when he was supposed to go to Disneyland with Brian, but he's instead hanging with the girlfriend. And then his cell phone starts ringing off the hook, and it's like 100 rings. And then he's just ignoring it. And then Brian starts calling the girlfriend's house nonstop like that, like a crazy person. And the girlfriend's mom is just like, oh, like he's molesting this kid. Like this is like a pedophile. He's like, this is not normal behavior to call a little boy like this off the hook and harass them to go to Disneyland with you. So she like corners him in the kitchen and is like, just tell me what's going on. What is going on? And
then she sent him to a therapist. Thank God for this woman, because she really tried to do everything right. She sent him to a therapist, but Drake said that he lied to the therapist initially because he didn't want to risk losing his job. Meanwhile, Brian sees him slipping away and he's trying to convince Dan Schneider to let himself play Drake's dad on his show. But eventually Drake said that something just broke. He has no idea what prompted it, but he was on the phone with his mom and told her everything. And the police got involved immediately.
Yeah. And he describes like the police coming to his house and like how traumatic it was, you know, how cold and uncaring they were, just making him list out in detail every single thing that had been done to him and when. And then at the end of that, they were like, all right, call him up right now and get him to admit this on the phone. And they had like multiple recorders out and multiple detectives sitting around and listening into this call that he makes confronting Brian about the years of abuse. And Brian does confess. He does admit to all of it and they talk and stuff. But he's like, are we being recorded right now? Are we being recorded right now? And
I wish his testimony was enough that they wouldn't then send this child in to go have to have this conversation to get him to admit everything. But
yeah, this is not trauma-informed care.
No.
It's horrific. His dad finds out. He's coping with this. The charges get brought. He starts drinking and stuff.
And this is where, so I'm gonna run through how he presents his story, and then I'm gonna talk more about the things that I think have been left out that is a choice that I wouldn't have made out of this documentary. But there's a lot of nuance to that, and this is also acknowledging that this is not taking away from Drake Bell's victimhood in any way, but rather acknowledging that someone can both be a victim and a perpetrator of abuse themselves. They gloss over a lot of what transpired with him, but you know, they touch on it briefly. So he says, you know, that he didn't know how to process things. Obviously he didn't go to therapy even after the investigation came out, and it led to self-destruction. He calls it self-loathing, alcohol abuse, substance abuse. They touch briefly on his charges for child endangerment, but meanwhile, no one reached out to him from Nickelodeon. He said the only person who was there for him was Dan. Brian Peck gets sentenced in 2004. And so because Drake Bell was a minor, his identity was under an alias and court documents were sealed. But on the day of his sentencing, Brian's side of the courthouse was full with lots of people from the industry, lots of people that Drake Bell recognized and had worked with. And on his side, it was just him, his mom, and his brother. Brian gets sentenced to 16 months in jail and has to register as a sex offender. And later on, we see, jumping forward to 20 years later, the journalists who were involved in this documentary petitioned to get the letters of support for Ryan unsealed. And there's 41 letters. We don't get letters of support from Dan Schneider or the top executives, but we do get them from all kinds of actors: James Marsden, Taron Killam, Alan Thicke, the X-Men producer, Tom DeSanto, Ryder Strong, and Will Friel from Boy Meets World. Joanna Kearns writes that there had to have been temptation laid out for Brian.
There's they show like five letters that use the same phrase, like extraordinary temptation, and he was pushed into it, and he must have broken under like so much endless pressure from this little boy. Like, it's crazy that obviously he was telling this story to these people, and there was one actress who like gave a statement to the documentary being like, I was lied to, and if I had known this, you know, I wouldn't have written the letter. It's like, how dumb are we as adults, like, that you would ever believe for a second that a child would pressure an adult into sex? It's just crazy that somebody, that so many 41 people out there believed so passionately, that they took to a legal document to be like, free my boy Brian Peck, he's just a man, and you know, after this little boy wore him down, he gave in to temptation. And who among us, like, wouldn't do something similar? Like, it's beyond.
And I don't know what's crazier, the fact that those letters exist or the fact that then Brian gets out of jail and gets hired back into a Disney show. He gets released from prison, is hired back on The Suite Life of Zack and Cody. I'm like, is there not another fucking dialect coach out there?
I mean, it's just crazy. It's just because he has so many people who want to do him favors and stuff. And like, they touch on this a bit in the documentary. They're like, there can be laws passed, like the law, they had like a law recently passed that said don't allow sex offenders to work with children in the movie industry. But it's like, no one knows about that law. No one enforces it. No one looks for it. No one scans for it. No one does background checks. Like, they're trying. Like, I know Corey Feldman in his documentary was like pushing so hard to get bills passed that had mandatory background checks for this kind of thing for everyone hired on set. And, you know, only just recently did Nickelodeon, after their third pedophile, which we're heading up for now, they only started doing background checks for freelancers like a few years ago.
Yeah. So the third pedophile in a short period of time gets convicted, Ezel Chanel, and he had a prior conviction as a sex offender and committed more crimes on the Nickelodeon set. It's hard because obviously you need background checks, but there it's challenging when Brian wasn't a sex offender prior to being hired.
Not registered. But they have footage of him feeling up Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
They have footage of him being a pedo for years. And it's just a shame that I'm sure somebody spoke up to someone at some point about this man.
Yeah.
Off the record or whatever.
Yeah, but then it seems like no one really cared all that much because these three arrests happen. This is just who's arrested, by the way. We know out of the world of people committing crimes and sexually assaulting people, very few actually get convicted and go to jail. So these are the three actual arrests. After this, Nick gets even more successful. Like, they basically reach the pinnacle after these arrests. It's in the mid-2000s. It reaches its height with iCarly, Drake and Josh, Sam and Kat. And yeah, like iCarly, it's again that trailblazing. Like, iCarly was an internet-based show in the mid-2000s, which was very well timed for the internet taking off. Like, this was the show that Michelle Obama was on. And meanwhile, you know, Disney's trying to compete with them with Hannah Montana and The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. So going back to Dan Schneider, we see so much behind-the-scenes footage because this was another avant-garde thing that he did, which was taking footage of everything. He would film in the writer's room, film the actors in between takes, do little interviews. He would post clips online, and we see in these clips, it really reveals so clearly the fear and the power imbalance, where he would be pranking actors by grabbing girls from behind and them shrieking, but you can see they're not able to react how they want to and they have to laugh it off.
Yeah, they look really scared. All the girls look very, very scared whenever Dan comes up with the camera, and it's tough to watch.
Yeah, and after in this world of post arrests of what is a rampant problem with pedophiles working on set, we have the show Victorious, which arguably pushed limits the most. This is the one that Ariana Grande was in, when so many compromising positions, so many filming so many scenes that revolved around innuendos. And that was really bad.
They had her putting her feet in her mouth, pouring water all over herself upside down and like choking on it. Like, oh my god, it was so bad.
And then they have, meanwhile, they, if again, with the gaslighting, so if people are bringing up this issue, they're again accused of being the warped ones because they're saying, like, they're not doing anything illegal. This is a comedy sketch for kids. And that's a theme just throughout horrible people doing horrible things. It's a joke. Can't take a joke. Nothing illegal is happening.
He's in his monster era at this point. Like, he's like, thinks he's beyond any consequences.
Yeah, and while there have been societal changes since this time, one of the people they interviewed for the documentary was Sketchy Cool, who's a culture writer, and she said, I thought this was very salient. She said, culturally, we're still doing the torture genius routine, where if a guy's a total piece of shit, it's like, oh, he must be so good at his job. And this is aside from crimes and all the things we're talking about. We still see male directors, producers, etc., running their set like this militant under these horrific conditions, but it's like they're a tortured genius. Like, this is their art. This is their method.
It almost, in some ways, I feel like gets you more respect because people are more willing to like jump through the hoops for you and like, you know, like the Kanye defenders and everything. Like, it's,
yeah. And it's like, it in that line, so like, yeah, the method actors, like, you never see men being method actors for someone who's a good person.
No, it's always like the Joker.
Yeah. Yeah. And at this time, Sam and Kat actually gets an internal investigation done because of allegations of Dan being awful to everyone on set. And the result of this investigation is that he's now, after this, not allowed to interact with the cast anymore, but they didn't get rid of him. 3 years after he's banned from working with actors, he's back. But culture has changed. We have the Me Too movement, which has taken off. There's rumors. Another investigation is launched, and he gets dropped and given an alleged settlement of $7 million with, quote, no findings of inappropriate actions with minors, but proof of abuse of power. And, you know, he says in 2021 that he tells the New York Times that he's ready to reemerge into children's TV.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah. So now just on to my commentary about this documentary. I honestly watched it and I texted Kelly from Beyond the Blinds and I was like, Kelly, am I going to get canceled if I say that I think that there could have been other sides explored to Drake Bell? And she was like, I'm thinking the same thing. Like, you know, in the sense that there can be someone who's had horrific, horrific actions committed to them and have done so many things themselves. And I think that that's part of the story, because there's a lot of people who experience abuse and then don't go and become abusers themselves. And it's a really delicate topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think, like, we're certainly not, I don't know, the documentary even, I don't think it's like, not to excuse it, but it would be good to examine it as something that can happen. Not every victim, of course, not every victim goes on to be a perpetrator, but some do. And I think there can be compassion for that this actually can like warp you and like ruin you in a way. Because he ended up doing it the exact same. Like he was groomed between ages 12 to 15 and abused, and his victims were 12 to 15 as well. That's when he, you know, and when you repeat a pattern like that, I mean, it's psychologically complex, but
yeah,
he doesn't deserve to be excused for those behaviors, which they let him say it was misinformation in the documentary, which was very fucked up.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You can have his perspective, which we hear from him that, you know, he said, I did bad things like DUIs and acting out and other things that were inappropriate, and then saying, oh, there was a lot of misinformation. You can have him saying that. They do think it's important to provide context.
They should have shown a quote from the victim. The victim has spoken out.
Well, there's been multiple victims. So the first allegations that came out were in August of 2020. He had an ex-girlfriend, Melissa Lingefelt, who they dated when she was 16 and he was 20. In all the articles that I read about them, I couldn't find anyone addressing their age difference and how she was a minor. And she accused him of physical and verbal abuse. He discounted this. She tells a story of very horrific physical and verbal abuse, and he discounts her story. He said that he never abused. He said, I never abused my ex-girlfriend or did any of the things that she falsely claimed in her video. As our relationship ended more than a decade ago, we unfortunately both called each other terrible names, as often happens when couples are breaking up, but that's it. And then he goes on to say, clearly, Melissa still felt close enough to me just last year that she was comfortable reaching out to ask me to provide her with financial support during a tough time, which I did. I don't know if today's behavior is some kind of misguided quest for more money or attention, but I cannot and will not allow these offensive and defamatory allegations to go unchallenged. And so that's the first event. And then the second is in July of 2021, where he actually gets charged eventually for child endangerment. So this is, again, I read so many articles, saw very few acknowledging the age gap. So his victim was 12 when they met. He's 12 years older than her. So when she was 12, he was 24. And she was a fan. They met. And in her testimony in court, she talked about being groomed and she described him as a pedophile. She said he caused her indescribable pain. And she said that her life hasn't been the same since she was 15, that she thinks about these crimes every single day, that she's in a horrific place. She had idolized him, that he was calculating, that he preyed on her and abused her, and said that he's a monster and a danger to children, and he's only sorry that he's finally been caught. And Drake's lawyer rejected this. He pleaded not guilty. He said that he accepts his plea because he said, my conduct was wrong. I'm sorry that my victim was harmed in any way. That was obviously not my intention. I've taken this matter very seriously, and I just want to apologize to anyone else who may have been offended. But meanwhile, his lawyer, Ian Friedman, offered a statement to NBC News, which was discounting a lot of her testimony. So it said that the victim's allegations went beyond that which all parties agreed to. They not only lack supporting evidence, but are contradicting by the facts learned through extensive investigation. As the court made clear, this plea was never about sexual misconduct or sexual relations with any person, let alone a minor, and discounts that there was any... She said that there were inappropriate photos sent to her. He said that this was false and that there was no proof of this. And also made statements about Drake Bell's loss of employment and how much he suffered because of her.
Well, and they also denied the victim said there was sexual relations between them backstage and in a hotel room. And him and his lawyer said that never happened. So it's a two extremely different stories. His was that he was, I think this is on Snapchat perhaps, but it was like, we exchanged pictures, but once I found out her age, that she lied to me about her age, I stopped. And there was no physical contact. So it's like, did they fucking meet or did they not meet? Like, can we not get any verification of this? Like, I believe the victim, as I always do, but I just find it crazy that he's able to skate on this if he did meet this girl.
Well, also, we know that the legal system doesn't do much to uphold victims. So that was not something that was proven in court. But what was proven was that they were in contact from age 12 to 15, when she was ages 12 to 15.
Right, yeah. 12 to 6. Yeah, it was like 3 or 4 years of them talking. So clearly something was fucking going on. Something very serious. I'm sure a lot of actors get a lot of Snapchats, a lot of nude pics, but they don't talk to someone for 4 years online.
You don't need to ask a 12-year-old how old they are and then find out that they're underage.
Yeah, that they're not
20.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't really confuse a 12-year-old for an 18, 19, 20-year-old. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that he has a pattern. And if he had gotten better help, maybe he wouldn't have gone on to harm other people. But he says he never went to therapy, not once. And he was left to deal with his shit alone. And that he handled it horribly, which at least he's being honest about that.
Yeah. And he is a victim and he has created more victims, which is something that can happen in this. And I understand why the documentary didn't explore that. This is the first time he's ever spoken out. His testimony is very powerful, extremely disturbing. I get it, but I was left walking away and the side of me that's just also thinking about, like, you Google his name and
his name and child endangerment, which I did to try and find the details of this. Now all that comes up is Drake Bell bravely tells story of when he was an endangered child. It's completely buried, the other stuff.
Yeah, it is completely buried. And a twist of all this, after the allegations came out, the first ones in 2020 from his ex-girlfriend, he actually moved to Mexico and is now pretty famous in Mexico. So he changed his stage name from Drake Bell to Drake Campana, and Campana is Spanish for Bell. And he was on the Mexican Masked Singer. He has toured with his music exclusively in Mexico. He's put out all Spanish albums. He's not Mexican, by the way. He's American. I had to look this up because I was like, has he gone back to his home country? Like, I don't know. He posts in Spanish now, or he was posting only in Spanish, like making posts about Mexican Independence Day, has just like assimilated into Mexican culture and has become a bit of a star in his own right there. Since
talk about
this.
A rebrand. We yeah. simply don't see this happen.
Yeah, yeah. Drake Campana. I know you'd think with technology it wouldn't fly, but no, Drake Campana is doing his thing in
Drake
Mexico.
Campana has never harmed a minor. He is a free man.
He doesn't know anything. Yeah, he's roaming free. And so I heard about all that before this documentary came out. I think that I'm glad the documentary came out. And there's just another part that I would have appreciated being explored.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't give them a zero on how they handled it. But the victims deserve to have their quotes up on the screen, at least the other side of the story.
Yep. Their testimonies that were made in court and
they should have been asked to comment, and I feel like they would have. Like and they have, like, since. Like, I saw that his ex, who said that he dragged her down the stairs, had posted being like, "Hey, like, just to all the death people sending me death threats, like, I do feel bad for him and I do honor that he was a victim, but that doesn't mean that he didn't do this to me and that it didn't hurt me. Just FYI." Like, basic, you know, fucking humanity here, people.
Yeah, and the ability to hold on to different truths that aren't mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But the public doesn't love that type of layering or nuance or anything like that.
No, they just want a pure victim and a pure villain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So that's where we end things. Thanks for coming along with us for this topic. Back tomorrow, the new episode, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. So.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.